This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
What's most exciting about this, I think, is that anyone on Earth can now use this system to look into deforestation hotspots. You know, it's not just us, it's all sorts of groups that now can sort of leverage this global monitoring system and see whether companies are actually living up to their commitments.
Monoculture. It displaces native plant and animal species, it leads to long-term soil quality degradation, and in tropical areas, it often means the raising of those beautifully biodiverse, carbon-capturing rainforests. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Rhett Butler, the founder of the popular nonprofit environmental science and conservation website, Manga Bay. When we checked in last with Butler, he talked about the rapid expansion of palm oil cultivation and its ripple effect on ecosystems all over the tropics. Today, he provides an update on the proliferation of palm oil monoculture, as well as the impact of the newly ubiquitous and delicious explosion in coconut products. He explains how social media and technology are helping to ensure more accurate monitoring of deforestation and are effectively amplifying the voices of activists and small farmers all over the globe. I'm joined again on Sea Change Radio by the founder and president of Manga Bay, Rhett Butler. Rhett, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
So it's been a few years since you've been on the show, and I wanted to touch base on a number of topics that Manga Bay generally focuses on. Why don't you reacquaint our listeners first with Manga Bay?
Sure. Manga Bay is a conservation, news, and environmental science website. I founded it in 1999. And it's now one of the more popular sites in this space. So we do a lot on forests, but also wildlife and oceans.
So we've had Rolf Skaar on from Greenpeace, who's talked about a lot of the efforts in deforestation that Greenpeace has been making. Why don't you catch us up on some of the reasons why we should be hopeful about forests and some of the shining examples of efforts to save forests?
Yeah, so there are a few reasons to be optimistic. Recent data has shown that deforestation has continued essentially at this very high rate for the last decade, essentially. So a lot of people are pessimistic, but there are some reasons to be optimistic. One of which is there are new tools that are more widely available through technology that are allowing us, like never before, to see what's happening in forests, but also to monitor what companies are doing. So these are things that you know, range from satellite imagery all the way down to mobile phones. I can give some examples later, but these tools are essentially enabling almost anyone to be an activist or a journalist to essentially report on what's happening. So that's one area that's really interesting. Another area that gives me reason for hope is the progress that activist groups are making in going after big companies that buy commodities produced at the expense of forests. So there's palm oil, there's pulp and paper, there's cattle, there's soy. So groups like Greenpeace and the Rainforest Action Network have been going after these companies that essentially are ultimately responsible for a large proportion of global deforestation and getting them to adopt policies that restrict deforestation from their supply chains. So at this point, we're kind of at the commitment level, but they're starting to do implementation. And this is really critical to eventually ending deforestation.
Many of us have followed the efforts in South America, Brazil, and Ecuador in fighting big oil and protecting the rainforest. Let's talk about how the issues are linked in big oil and protecting forests.
Well, yeah. So oil has traditionally been a driver of deforestation in certain regions, so especially in the Western Amazon. So there's this long-running issue with oil development in Ecuador. And oil development itself doesn't directly drive that much deforestation, but a lot of the infrastructure that supports oil does. So building the roads to get to these points, those roads are then followed by illegal loggers, by poachers, by colonists, and that results in a lot of deforestation that goes beyond just oil extraction. The other big issue with oil, of course, is pollution. So pipelines break, waste is dumped into streams. So those are kind of the long-running issues in the oil sector. I would extend it a little beyond that to say, to look at energy generally. So there's also hydroelectric dams. So there's very large hydroelectric dams being built in the Amazon. There's more than 300 dams that are scheduled to be built or are under construction right now. And these dams often flood large areas of forests. So they drive a lot of emissions through killing vegetation. But they have the same similar issues to oil, where you the infrastructure that supports these dams drives deforestation by other actors. So, you know, small farmers, illegal loggers, things like that. Another component to the whole energy issue is mining. So a lot of coal extraction is happening right now in places like Indonesia and Borneo. And a lot of this coal is at the surface. So it requires, you know, stripping the land, stripping the forest to extract the coal. And then a final area, which is not, maybe is not realizing its full potential at this point, is biofuels. So a few years ago, there's a lot of talk about all these biofuel crops and sort of the best opportunity for expanding those in terms of where land is available was in the tropics. So there's a lot of expansion for oil palm and other crops that people thought were going to go into to biofuel feedstocks. And so there was a lot of concern that demand for biofuels could drive a lot of deforestation. So cutting down forests, it's very biodiverse. So you might have, you know, 200 to 400 different types of trees in a single hectare being cut down for a monoculture of oil palm or sugar or corn.
And how you mentioned the power of cell phones and new technologies that are allowing smaller actors, individuals, small farmers, people who aren't necessarily organized, able to actually make a difference. Why don't you give us some examples if you can?
So one area where technology is really helping is on the monitoring side. So essentially anyone can essentially report what's happening on the ground. So if a company comes in and starts cutting down forests, there can be local activists or even villagers who then report that and feed it back into the system. So there's now new platforms like Global Forest Watch, which is this portal which grabs or aggregates all different types of forest data into a single place. And so those bottom-up reports can end up feeding into a system like that where activists and NGOs and other groups can, you know, look into the issue. Another area that's been important has been the whole supporting organizing. So in the past, you might have one village whose, you know, traditional forest has been encroached or invaded by a company, and it was essentially that one village versus the company. So it's a battle that was rarely won. But these days, that village can connect with other villages that may be facing the same threats or dealing with the same issues, and they can talk to each other. So it's a way for these villages to come together and present a united front. And together, they're stronger when going up against, you know, the government or these big companies that are coming in and cutting down community forests.
And where specifically have we seen some recent successes in this area?
Well, this is happening a lot in Indonesia. Indonesia just happens to have decent mobile phone networks, and there's this a lot of conflict between big companies and small communities. And so the issue really comes to a head. And a major component to this problem has been the traditional way the government has given out concessions to companies. So essentially all forest land in Indonesia is owned by the government. So even if a community has used an area of forest, you know, sustainably managed it for, you know, generations, the government can still come in and take away that land and give it to a company. And so that historically has been a major point of conflict, because you'll have a community that's using a forest, and then government will grant it to a company. The company comes in with, you know, with security forces or often just thugs, and will chase people off the land and then cut down all the trees for a monoculture acacia or eucalyptus plantation or an oil palm plantation. So it essentially forcibly displaces this community. And so the community then will look for other areas of forest, you know, maybe a national park nearby, and they'll encroach on that for their daily needs. And so
that's been the traditional model, at least
exactly,
over the last few decades, but that's starting to shift.
There's signs that it's starting to shift. So a bunch of these companies have now agreed to these zero deforestation commitments, which actually go beyond just deforestation. There are human rights components and social safeguards built in. So there's this concept of free prior informed consent, where when a company is establishing a new plantation, they have to get consent from the communities that they're allowed to do so. So that has created a new area for conversations. The other thing that's been happening is in Indonesia, the Constitutional Court has ruled that the business as usual approach, where the government gives out these community lands to companies to, you know, for their own use, is illegal. And so that's opened up the potential for a lot of forest areas to be given back to the communities, or communities' rights to be recognized to those lands. So it's unclear exactly how things are going to pan out, but potentially that could mean that areas that were once gazetted or going to be gazetted for industrial logging or industrial conversion will now be community forests.
And it's whispered that soon, if we all call the tune, then the piper will lead us to reason, and a new day will dawn for those who stand long, and the forests will echo with laughter.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with the founder and president of Manga Bay, Rhett Butler. So Rhett, take us through how a small-time farmer in Indonesia might be able to create major ripple effects that affect what we would be buying in Safeway.
Today's social media and just the internet generally has completely changed the equation for going after issues like deforestation. So you may have a smallholder in a place like Sumatra who lives in a village that has traditionally managed an area of forest. It's a community forest. You know, they rely on this forest for, you know, for food, you know, collecting medicines, you know, supplying water. And in the past, if a company came in and wanted to clear that forest, there was very little recourse for them. Well, today it's different. They can reach out to networks via mobile phones and Facebook and things like that. And so what we're seeing happening is one of these small communities will lodge a complaint against a company. That complaint could be picked up by an environmental group like Greenpeace, and then Greenpeace then goes after the company that buys commodities from this local, say, Indonesian company. So they might go after someone like Nestle, which is a consumer-facing company, and target it with a campaign. So a great example of this was from a few years ago when Greenpeace indeed went after Nestle, and they wanted to showcase the issue that Nestle's palm oil was potentially being sourced at the expense of orangutan habitat. So they created a video spot, a dramatization, where they had an office worker biting into a Kit Kat bar. But when he opened the Kit Kat bar, it was actually an orangutan finger. So when he bit into the Kit Kat, it bled down his face. I mean, so again, this is a dramatization, but it created a very powerful image that Nestle didn't have strong enough safeguards for its palm oil. Nestle didn't particularly like that campaign.
No, I can imagine not.
And they ended up adopting this very progressive policy, which was essentially a zero deforestation policy. Now, that policy became the model for all the other policies that have since been adopted by these companies. And what's interesting about these policies is they've created Well, first of all, their commitments. So big companies don't want to violate public commitments. It just doesn't look good. But another thing that's happened is it's created a new point of leverage for environmentalists to go after companies if they break their commitments or if any of their suppliers break the commitments. So if a small Indonesian company that you've never heard of is clearing forest in Indonesia and threatening these local communities, if they ultimately sell to a company that sells to Nestle, they have to abide by the policy as well. So it's a way for environmentalists to now go after all these companies that before were sort of out of the network. So if a small farmer lodges a complaint via the online complaint system that, you know, Nestle or these other group, other companies have, it essentially enables them or the farmer to defend his land against these random companies that normally would be part of any system. So it's a very powerful tool for going after these drivers of deforestation.
It's also interesting to see how the technology has allowed us to collect data in an exponential fashion. I'm thinking back to a country that has probably the richest history of forest preservation, Japan. 300-400 years ago, there are records of the Japanese saying this shogunate has 550 birch trees, 780 ash trees. Like, they were very meticulous on their keeping records. And this is a country that has very limited land resources for the amount of people that live in Japan. We're now taking that across the globe, and we kind of have to if we want to preserve these forests. And it sounds like because of these technologies, it's becoming a reality in some cases.
Yeah, it's really cool what's possible now. So at Manga Bay, we're testing out how well the system works. And so what we're doing is we're building out a network of correspondents around the world to essentially leverage for looking into various environmental issues. But when we wanted to do a pilot project, we partnered with Global Forest Watch, which again is this platform for grabbing essentially big data around forests and putting it, aggregating in one place. And so within Global Forest Watch, there's this tool which shows potential deforestation on a monthly basis. So you can look at the map and there will be a bright pink spot that pops up representing a place where there's been a significant change in forest cover or forest disturbance. And so to test this idea, last year I went to North Sumatra where there was this pink blotch that had popped up right in a protected area. And this area was significant because it's the only place on Earth that has orangutans, tigers, elephants, and rhinos living in the same forest. So it has very high value for wildlife. And so this pink blotch had popped up, you know, right in this forest. And so I decided to go see what was actually happening on the ground there. We went to the site. We found this road that wasn't on the map, but had recently been built. Followed the road. We went over the crest, and then all of a sudden we came into this area that was a very short time ago forest was now cleared for an oil palm plantation. So this, you know, sitting on a laptop here in California, I was able to see an area of interest. And then we went and visited the site, and it turned out that, you know, what was on the computer was actually happening on the ground.
And what became of that discovery?
Well, so it's actually being investigated now. So there's been a lawsuit filed against the company. And there's a local NGO that's working to see how that company's palm oil would end up going into the global supply chain. Because the forest has just been cleared, it's going to take 3 to 5 years for the trees to actually start producing. So it's not actually that product is not actually in the supply chain yet. But trying to understand how it would end up being in the supply chain and how it would be governed by these commitments. So it's, you know, it's potentially too late, you know, to stop that deforestation. But it's not too late for the forest to return if you know that plantation were cut down or, you know, or blocked. There's still forest all around it. So there is potential. But what's most exciting about this, I think, is that anyone on Earth can now use this system to look into deforestation hotspots. And so at Manga Bay, you know, we have this network out there now, which is already looking into these hotspots. So, you know, we have a correspondent, say, in New Guinea, where, you know, deforestation pops up, that correspondent can then go and visit that site, talk to a company, see what's happening. We have people in Cameroon and Central African Republic who can do the same. So, you know, it's not just us, it's all sorts of groups that now can sort of leverage this global monitoring system and see whether companies are actually living up to their commitments.
Yes, stars shining bright above you. Night breezes sing to whisper I love you. Birds singing in the sycamore trees. Dream a little dream of me, yes. Say nighty night and kiss me. Just hold me tight and tell me you miss me. While I'm alone and blue as can be, dream a little dream of me. Stars fading, but I linger on, dear.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the founder and president of Manga Bay, Rhett Butler. So Rhett, you're our go-to guy on palm oil here at Sea Change Radio. You know more about palm oil than anyone I've ever spoken to. Give us an update on a progress report, if you will.
Well, on a positive front, a lot of the largest companies that source and trade palm oil have now adopted these deforestation-free commitments. And these commitments apply to all their suppliers. So that's very encouraging because it means there are now social and environmental safeguards that are being applied to palm oil. Of course, there's still palm oil outside those agreements, but it's a minority of the palm oil. So that's very hopeful that palm oil can move from something that drives deforestation to something that doesn't drive deforestation and produces a lot of vegetable oil, to help feed the planet, essentially. So that transition is starting to happen. Another big item sort of in the palm oil world has been a drop in prices. So the drop in palm oil price is essentially discouraged expansion in a lot of areas. So places where palm oil would kind of be a marginal crop, the drop in prices means that it's not being produced right now. So that's bought some time.
That's good news in terms of trying to limit these monocultures being propagated all over the world. But how has it affected some of these communities? Has it been a negative impact for some of these developing countries where the vulnerable population was promised the moon and then the prices crashed to the floor?
Yeah, so certainly it could affect small communities that are planning to produce palm oil to feed into the larger system. So their palm oil may be less viable. But actually, a bigger issue in the palm oil sector is the quality of the seed. Which may sound strange, but a smallholder, they generally in a place like Indonesia, they have lower quality seed. And so the problem is that you don't realize this is an issue until 5 or 10 years down the road when their plantations are producing 2 tons per hectare, whereas a corporate plantation which uses good quality seed maybe 3 or 4 times that. And so what that effectively does is it greatly reduces the livelihoods for these people, their opportunities to earn money. You know, they're getting paid for just 2 tons per hectare, whereas they could be getting 7 without further chemical input. So we're not talking about more fertilizers, things like that. It's purely the quality of the seeds they're using. And that's a major gap. I mean, so the problem is that if you want to produce 10 tons of palm oil and you're getting 2 tons per hectare, you need to clear 5 hectares of forest.
So it's an efficiency issue, really.
Right. So, but if you had a strain that was generating 5 tons per hectare, that's only two hectares of forest. So it's just an efficiency thing. Mm-hmm. So that's an issue that's often overlooked. And it's a major problem. And actually, it's one place where smallholders can agree with big companies because no one essentially benefits from having underproducing crops. If you've already cleared the forest, then you might as well get as high a productivity as you can, especially if you don't have to use chemical inputs on it.
And one of the tropical oils that's become very much in vogue, especially in my household, is coconut oil. The health benefits have been espoused by many, and a lot of people like coconut oil, and it's become very popular. in American households, but how sustainable is it, Rhett?
I can't speak to the health benefits of coconut oil versus any other oil, but coconut oil is not a panacea. So
from a forestry standpoint.
So the issue is that if you want to expand coconut plantations, you often need to clear forest. And so in North Sulawesi, where I was a couple of years ago, there are vast areas of highly biodiverse forests that have been cut down for coconut plantations.
What country is that?
It's in Indonesia. Sulawesi is a really interesting place. It's full of all sorts of unique species. But if you're looking to you know, stop palm oil expansion by doing more coconut, then you have a problem because coconut yields are a lot lower than palm oil. So you'd have to clear a lot larger area of forest to do coconut than you would if you were growing oil palm.
And are some of these more aggressive coconut plantations, are they also planting organic coconut? Or as a consumer, can you just buy organic coconut oil and have a little bit more peace of mind that it's being grown responsibly? Or what are some of the standards that an informed consumer should look for?
So I don't know the coconut market very well. If you're buying organic coconut oil, that doesn't necessarily mean it wasn't cut, that a forest wasn't cut down to produce that oil. It means maybe you didn't use pesticides or fertilizers, but you could still very well have large scale deforestation to produce coconut oil that would still be certified as organic. On the palm oil side, there is organic palm oil. That tends to be less of an issue for most consumers. It's more about whether that palm oil was produced at the expense of a forest. So the leading certification initiative within the palm oil sector is called the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil, or RSPO. The RSPO doesn't ban deforestation, but it does require certain environmental practices to be observed. It also, you know, has guidelines for reducing fertilizer and pesticide use. But generally, more companies now are adopting safeguards that actually go beyond the RSPO, so beyond certification, where they have zero deforestation commitments.
And palm oil is often just an ingredient in a product. It's people don't go out and buy palm oil in the store as much in this country. They do in others, right?
Yeah, in the United States, most palm oil we consume is in other products. So it's used as a fat, a vegetable fat. So it would be in a lot of processed foods, also a lot of cosmetic products, you know, shampoo, soap, things like that. But in other countries, it would be used a lot as a cooking oil. And it's generally, you know, a very cheap cooking oil, which is why it's so widely used.
And about what percentage of RSPO approved palm oil is going out into the market? Do you have any idea? Is it a tiny slice or is it becoming fairly significant?
I believe RSPO represents 15 to 20% of the global market.
That's not insignificant at all.
It's not insignificant. But again, there are these now zero deforestation commitments, which by some estimates is more than 90% of the market. They're still in the commitment phase rather than the implementation phase, but that potentially has a much bigger impact than just the certification because it just applies to a lot larger percentage of the production.
Well, if our listeners want to know more about palm oil and deforestation, I highly recommend they go to Manga Bay. He's the president and founder of Manga Bay, Rhett Butler. Rhett, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thanks again.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Joe Henry, Led Zeppelin, and Louis Armstrong. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.